Hi, you're listening to The Third Degree. I'm Simon Unwin. Good morning. A couple of weeks ago, we learned a little about the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's part of the world where territorial disputes, military forces and mining interests intersect in ways that are fairly undeniably horrible, but don't get a great deal of play in the rest of the world's media. But closer to home, in West Papua, massive gold mines dump toxic sludge into river systems, an independence movement is aggressively crushed by Indonesian soldiers, and political leaders are assassinated. And only rarely do we hear about it, in part due to a fairly effective media blackout enforced by the Indonesian military. In response to that media blackout in the region, a variety of people inside and outside of West Papua have formed West Papua Media, an organisation which attempts to bring independent West Papuan news to the rest of the world. So Nick Chesterfield is a member of the West Papua Media editorial team, and he joined us yesterday in the studio to discuss West Papua's struggle for independence from Indonesia.
Well, basically, West Papua was first and foremost invaded by Indonesia in 1962, and it's been fighting a 50-year struggle of resistance, both using armed resistance and now, more importantly, civil resistance and non-violent campaigning. And basically, people are literally at this point fighting for their survival. The Indonesians have taken over West Papua for the minerals, a vast amount of minerals that are present in there, and the vast amount of forest and natural resources that are in massive abundance. And the people who've been living for tens of thousands of years in total harmony with the land were thrust into a Cold War struggle where their land was handed over by the Dutch and the Americans over to Indonesia without their involvement, without their consent. What's happening today is a very strong escalation of assassinations and violence against non-violent activists by the Indonesian security forces, and human rights abuses that are just continuing unchecked. We've got three major military offensives happening in West Papua at the moment, in the Paniai region, in the highlands, in Puncak Jaya, and also against activists using the Australian-funded Detachment 88 counter-terror unit right across the territory. People are getting a little bit demoralised inside. They're preparing for their extinction. People are understanding that they're about to be wiped out because they think the international community just simply doesn't care.
I suppose it's something that we talked about a little bit the other week when we had a show discussing the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Something that we discussed a lot during that show was how there are places in the world, such as West Papua and the Congo, where really quite terrible things are happening and quite newsworthy things.
But it's out of sight and out of mind.
So yeah. Why do you think that is? Why do we not hear about this stuff?
Well, one thing that I've always suggested and that West Papua Media has been established for was to counter the what I call the willful ignorance of news editors and journalists in the mainstream media in the West to cover the situation, and not just the West for that matter, that people are quite comfortable with taking the natural resources from Papua, but they're very uncomfortable about reporting the costs of it. There's also the issue, of course, that because international media has not been reporting the situation for so long, people, if they started reporting it now, people would ask them why they haven't for 40 years. I mean, they've had plenty of opportunity. It's not far away. We've just demonstrated again with the ABC 7:30 report how easy it is to get journalists in there undercover, and any journalists who hear this who want to go in, just give us a buzz. One of the things that we were started for, of course, was with West Papuan people and West Papuan human rights workers and also international solidarity activists as well as journalists, was to basically counter the foreign media ban that Jakarta's imposed. Journalists aren't welcome. Indigenous journalists and even Indonesian journalists have been routinely intimidated, stabbed, and in some cases murdered for reporting the truth in Papua. foreign journalists are regularly deported and are threatened with their lives. This is a situation that people on the ground are facing every single day, and they need people to actually stand strong and report it. It does involve risk, and you can't tell a story if a reporter is dead, but it is also something where people actually have to make that step to say, no, I'm here, I am still here, and I am witnessing it, and I am reporting it. And what we've done is, in the situation in Papua, if we can't get foreign media in, well, we just simply train local people to become the journalists.
That's one of the things that I find quite interesting and inspirational even about your organisation, is that you're sort of skilling up people on the ground to be citizen journalists. You know, that kind of, that bearing witness they may be already doing, but I guess the signal boost from having the website and...
Yeah, precisely.
That sort of thing.
And we've got established relationships with international media organisations. You're correct, it is exactly that, it's a signal boost. One thing that international journalists have a tendency to forget, and especially mainstream media, is you don't have a story without local stringers anyway. These are the people on the ground. These are your fixers. These are your people who set the story up, who find out where the information is. The, you know, most foreign journalists can't get a story without effective local contacts who know what is truth and what is fiction. We've taken that one step further by trusting our stringers, and certainly trusting our fixers once we've given them training, that they have the processes there to be able to sort the fact from the fiction, the confirmation from the rumour, and they're able to get a real clear and credible picture out of what's happening on the ground. You don't have to wait a couple of weeks to organise to send an international film crew in there. You've got people with cameras on their mobile phones or whatever, you know, and all sorts of cameras that folks have got on the ground. We've certainly sent a lot over in the time and always looking for donations for more. We have basically taken the view that anyone with a camera should be able to be a journalist and to be a safe journalist.
And I suppose, yeah, those are two equally important parts of the phrase, you know, being a journalist and being a safe journalist.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If we can talk a little bit more about the geopolitics of it, if you like, because I don't think that we necessarily have the struggle, the, you know, the ongoing conflict in West Papua related very much to the economics of
absolutely
of the area. So I mean, yeah, you were talking about the rich mineral resources of West Papua. I mean, what kind of minerals are we talking about?
Well, we're talking 27 of the world's most sought after resources in the most abundance in West Papua of anywhere on earth. So you're talking gold, copper, uranium, nickel, zinc, you name it, it's there. Oil, gas. What the Papuan struggle is simply an anti-colonial struggle. It is a country that has been colonised. After the Second World War, Dutch geologists who were working for Standard Oil at the time, instead of Royal Dutch Shell, their employer, discovered a massive, massive gold and copper deposit at a place called Erzbergen Grasberg, which is now today's Freeport mine. This was the largest motherlode of copper and gold on the planet. Its existence was not shared with the Dutch. It was shared only with the Americans and with Sukarno. Now, the Americans wanted that. They wanted a compliant regime to get a hold of that, and they engineered the handover of West Papua through the New York Agreement in 1961.
You were mentioning the Freeport mine and the deposits there. We did hear about the Freeport mine a little bit earlier this year. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
As I said, the Freeport mine is the largest copper and gold mine on Earth, 4,500 metres up in the sky on next to some of the world's last tropical glaciers. And basically, the Freeport is one of the richest gold mines on Earth. Can't remember the exact figures offhand, but most gold mines around the world pull out about 10 grams a tonne. Freeport pulls out 35 grams a tonne, yet the ore concentrate is up to 60 grams a tonne, and the rest they just wash downstream. So what that has meant is that there is a bonanza going on there. Freeport hardly pays any tax, even though it's 49% owned by Indonesia, and the tax that it does pay is up to 49% again of Indonesian taxation revenue. So it's a huge, huge economic interest for Indonesia to hold on to this mine. This is the number one reason why Indonesia invaded Papua in the first place. It's a closed military area. For the last couple of years, there's been these mysterious shootings that have gone on where they blame the OPM, the Free Papua Movement Armed Wing of the National Liberation Army, particularly when it was under the command of the late Kelly Kwalik. These shootings have been ongoing. Even after they killed Kelly Kwalik, the shootings still kept going. You know, they kill soldiers, they kill police officers, they kill mine company workers, teachers, civilians, whatever. And a lot of people have been shot dead over the years. And what it comes down to is the security situation in Freeport is particularly about who gets control of the spoils, literally the spoilage from the mine. Obviously, the TNI, there's a big problem at the Freeport mine where the TNI regularly walk into the assaying gold room.
The
Indonesian military, Tentara Nasional Indonesia. Their soldiers walk into the gold room where they do the assaying test pours. And they walk away with bullion quite regularly, and there's nothing the Freeport can do about it. Freeport has been paying $39 million a year on average for the last 10 years.
In bribes or in...
No, they call it lunch money. It's funding for Indonesian military activities, accommodation, vehicles, running costs.
And this is so that the Indonesian military can protect the mine from...
themselves.
How so?
There is a massive local opposition there. The situation, of course, with the indigenous people of the area, the Kamoro and Amungme people on the mine areas, and especially downstream where massive pollution happens. It's a scar that you can see from space. A massive, massive tailings dump that makes the Oktedi disaster look like a little mud pie. It is massive and it's ongoing and it's still ongoing. But the military and the police mobile brigade fight over who gets to process all those tailings and who gets to run an illegal gold mining trade on the side. They employ locals, they bring in transmigrants, there's a lot of hand panners, people who use mercury and cyanide with their hands and get health problems from there, trying to find nuggets of gold in the tailings. The TNI and the police, between them, the army run the bars, they run the brothels, they sell the shovels, they sell the cyanide, they sell the mercury, the police run the transportation, police run the accommodation, and there's fights over who runs what, because obviously prostitution, for instance, is the most lucrative of all of it. And so you've got all these little things that are going on that there's buck to be made everywhere, so that's the reason why they're providing security. And when they fight with each other, the police and army fight with each other about who gets the spoils over what, they both create this security disturbance which forces the mine to have to pay more money for protection.
One of the reasons that the Freeport mine was most recently in the news over here, at least, was workers at the mine taking industrial action, going on strike.
The bulk of the workers, that is the bulk of the workers from Indonesia and Papua, paid a pittance. Their safety is routinely compromised. They were routinely subject to security issues from the army and the police, and they were harassed all the time. They were paid less than $2 a day, while foreign reed white mine workers were getting what white mine workers get in Australia and even more. So people were rightly disgusted and they took industrial action, just saying enough is enough. You know, you're the most profitable mine on earth, pay us more than $2 a day. You know, there's a real disrespect for humanity that goes on with mine management. So they took a very unprecedented strike, and this was formed by the Indonesian Mines and Energy Union, the SPSI, and it started as, you know, basic wage demands, and then it took on a civil resistance character. The Indonesian mine workers suddenly were aware of the Papuan grievances, and so the Papuan workers, the Papuan landowners particularly, and the Indonesian mine workers were all starting to see the same picture and work together.
So it was quite a sort of crucial...
It was a crucial moment in awareness of normal Indonesian people about the real situation in West Papua.
Sure.
And those relationships are still strong. It's got to be remembered, this was not a political struggle, it was an economic struggle. It was a basic working condition struggle. And they're very careful to keep it separate from the independent struggle. But, you know, the point is they got the picture. And they were on strike for up to 8 months. It was huge. Not 1 ounce of gold was being moved.
In a situation like that, where, you know, there's a huge and quite important, you know, industrial action taking place, what role does West Papua Media Alerts have in getting that story out?
Well, we did work with the mine workers during that struggle. We had a lot of contact with SPSI mine workers, both directly from our editorial team and from some of our stringers. But the Indonesian media basically took over at a certain point. We still maintained independent contact, but we had acted as a bridge between the mine workers and mainstream media when we saw that they were getting their words out on Reuters and AAP and AFP, which we'd helped set up in the first place. Then, you know, we'd seen our job as done.
You're on The Third Degree with me, Simon Unwin. After this week's widely seen 7:30 report on the assassination of West Papuan independence leader Marco Toboni, I'm speaking to Nick Chesterfield from West Papua Media about the struggles the organisation reports on, but also the organisation itself. In terms of the way that it's structured, do you have the editorial team based in Australia or Papua or Indonesia?
Well, we've got a couple of helpers in Indonesia for media freedom and media safety reasons, more to the point, legislative media freedom protections. Members of the editorial are based in countries, editorial team are based in countries with those protections enshrined in law. As troublesome as the Australian media is, at least we do have that legal landscape, that we do have basic protections. And same goes with a couple of the other countries that folks are based in. You know, we certainly do have editorial team members inside, but most of our crew inside are stringers and contributors, sub-editors and stuff like that. So we are their international backup.
I guess turning to some of the news stories that have broken most recently, obviously, you know, a lot of people will have watched the 7:30 report about the killing of Marco Toboni. Also, I mean, something that was on the West Papua Media Alert site as recently as yesterday was a number of students being attacked by police or military. In a situation like that, are you able to dispatch people there to that scene, you know, really quickly, or are people going to be on the scene already almost?
I'll talk about that particular story because we had to make a correction on that story and... you know, you've got to acknowledge your mistakes as well as your positives. But one of the big problems, of course, that we do have is when something happens, it's usually the people on the ground that first contact us. So we will try and dispatch a stringer to the area. But in a situation when phone systems are down or the internet's down, sometimes we do have to rely on human rights workers who are there, lawyers, witnesses, political, you know, political activists as well. And to be quite honest, sometimes political activists mistranslate words, or especially in the case of political activists, they tend to exaggerate the situation and say that someone's killed when they're not killed. There's still a bit of confusion about this situation because it emerged first thing this morning that one of our independent witnesses retracted his statement from last night, saying that there were 3 people killed, whereas we've got evidence of 1 confirmed and a possibility of 2 more. So it's really, really hard. You can't really, you know, the word confirmed, dangerous word, because when you think it's all green and good to go, it's sometimes people will retract what they've said. So in that situation, it is absolutely vital to get someone who is trained in credible, safe witness journalism onto the scene as fast as possible. That wasn't available with the storm raid. Basically, there was a commotion outside, and a group of trans migrants set upon a student from a dormitory.
So when you say trans migrants, you mean people from Indonesia now living in
colonists. People who were literally shipped over from crowded areas in Indonesia to take over, colonise West Papua. And, yeah, basically a young man got set upon by a whole group of men and killed, beaten and killed and kicked to death, basically. And when students were investigating the commotion, they set upon the students as well, and then an hour later the police and the military raided. So they took over the whole dormitory, they smashed everything to pieces, they beat and tortured, like they took away 35 people, beat and tortured, like really heinously tortured people, as a matter of routine, not even for investigation, but they accused them all of being friends of Mako Tabuni, which of course they were from his clan, so of, you know, that they would have known him, and there a lot of them had been members of the KMPB, the West Papua National Committee. This comes on the back of a massive escalation in targeting of the KMPB by Indonesian security forces, and they are using all sorts of tactics, but especially they are using Detachment 88 troops, which are funded by Australia specifically and exclusively for counter-terror reasons, to be used to as death squads to assassinate anyone connected with KMPB, just bump them off one at a time, three at a time, four at a time. And there's been a lot of these brutal raids on the student dormitories.
It's interesting, actually, with the questions that are now being asked about Detachment 88 as part of that 7:30 report story. You know, the ABC posed a number of questions to the AFP. The line with Detachment 88 has been a lot about how that, you know, they were created in the wake of the Bali bombings, and for that reason received a lot of you know, funding and training from the Australian Federal Police. But yeah, in the statement they gave back to the ABC, they said something along the lines of, "You should note that the Indonesian government currently does not particularly distinguish between terrorism and separatist movements."
Well, fundamentally, the AFP should immediately end all support for Detachment 88, because this is against Australian law. The AFP is enabling violations of Australian law by funding attacks, violent assassinations, and training and equipping these people. These are all using Australian weapons. You know, they're equipping these people to carry out assassinations of non-violent, peaceful activists.
So that relationship is ongoing? That the funding and training is still...
Of course. JCLEC, which is a joint centre for law enforcement cooperation in Jakarta, is run by the AFP. The commandant is an AFP officer. They say they train them in human rights. They train them how to be aware of how to violate human rights. But the point is, if you are funding something, if you are providing training for something, you are responsible for how that is enacted. If you don't agree with it, or if it is counter to your law or your policy, you don't fund it. It is as simple as that.
In terms of looking to the future and looking at how, you know, how the struggle for independence in West Papua might develop or might be aided by people from around the world, the kind of pressure that we're seeing now being applied to, you know, the Australian government over this, is that something that you think will be able to really influence the situation on the ground?
If we can sustain this pressure, and if the Australian government has an ounce of decency, if it is really about human rights and the rule of law, which it is conveniently ignoring extrajudicial assassination, that is not the rule of law. That is dictatorship. So the pressure to end Australian military training and Australian support for units like not just Detachment 88, but Kopassus and COSTRAD and BRIMOB, and, you know, having those relationships with these war criminals. I mean, make no mistake about it, these people have the commanders of these units have been indicted by the United Nations Serious Crimes Unit as war criminals for their behaviours in East Timor. It's exactly the same thing.
I was going to ask about, I suppose there are a lot of parallels with the history of the East Timorese struggle for independence from Indonesia.
Absolutely. And one of the main things that happened with the East Timor struggle is the suspension of military aid and training to the Indonesians. What this is simply about is the rights of people to engage in peaceful, legitimate, free expression in their own country and to debate their own future without fear of getting killed. By removing an assassination force of death squads, by us refusing to fund them, we delegitimise them. We stop giving them the green light to go and murder people at will, and with total impunity. There is no justice. There is no accountability for this. If we end the provision of that training and funding, there is a democratic space where people can organise and people can use democratic processes at that point to determine their own future, which is every person's fundamental basic human right on this planet. And that's what this is all about. It is for the rights of all people to engage and enjoy their basic human rights. There's nothing more. If they want independence, that's their choice, but they've never been given that choice. So if we stop funding the killers, then, you know, Papuans might not be extincted at our hands.
You are on the Third Degree, and that was Nick Chesterfield, of the editorial team of West Papua Media, in conversation with me, Simon Unwin, yesterday. So you can read the latest independently verifiable news coming out of West Papua at westpapuamedia.info. That's westpapuamedia.info. That is it from us this week. Thanks for listening, and see you next week. We'll be right back.